Thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Jason Coleman, and you are listening to Things That Make You Go, Book Review Podcast. And welcome to another episode of Things That Make You Go, Book Review Podcast. I am your one-man book club, Jason Coleman. Okay, and thank you so much for being here for another episode. Today I'm going to be talking about the book Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. I hope I said his name correctly. I first want to preface by saying that this book deals a lot with race in America, specifically the plight of Black men in America. And that's a subject that I probably should talk more about, and I don't, mostly because I think that it's just so, being a white person talking about how I feel about Black people, it just seems so controversial and so, I don't know, there's just almost, I mean, at least among most white liberal people I know, myself being included, we just almost don't even really want to talk about any of it because we don't want to offend anybody. We don't want to, we feel as if we might accidentally voice an opinion that isn't accepted. We're going to be basically crucified and labeled as a racist. And so we just tend not to get into those issues at all. But I think that it's not a good idea to necessarily do that because I think part of the reason why relations and improvements among minorities, specifically Black men, has been so slow. I heard a statistic that's said something like around the 1960s, mid-1960s, black people controlled about 2% of the country's wealth. And 50 years later, Black people still control about 2% of the country's wealth. So it just goes to show that I don't know how much improvement is really being made. And if we're not even willing to talk about these issues, I don't think anything is ever really going to change. So I'm trying to move myself out of that block a bit. And I first became interested in the book Between the World and Me because I used to watch All In with Chris Hayes, a news show on MSNBC. And Chris Hayes does mostly politics, but he was a journalist from New York City. And so a lot of people who are living in New York City, working as artists or journalists or in the field in one way or another, he had contact with. So he would bring him on his show for interviews from time to time. And I first became interested in Ta-Nehisi Coates when he wrote a piece in Time magazine that talked about the case for reparations among Black people. And if you don't know what reparations are, it's a movement where the United States government would actually just give financial resources to Black people in order to help them achieve equality. This has got to be one of the most, toxic political issues among most current politicians. I can remember Bernie Sanders, who is, you know, probably the most successful liberal politician in, I don't know, the last 75 years or so. They asked him about what he thought about reparations, and he just said, it was interesting, actually. He didn't say that he disagreed with reparations, and I thought that was really significant. He said that he didn't feel that it was politically feasible right now. And I don't know, personally, maybe that would have been a victory from my point of view, because number one, he didn't say no, that we shouldn't have it for whatever reason. And he didn't even say that at some point in the future, it wouldn't be available. He just said that right now, politically, it's not doable. And that really made Ta-Nehisi Coates very upset. I remember he came on Chris Hayes and he was just saying that it was unfortunate that Bernie Sanders had said that. And there's really no reason why they shouldn't pursue this at this point in time. But I don't know. I'm a bit torn on it. But anyway, what reparations are is this whole idea of after slavery ended, I mean, Black people were slaves in the United States for over 200 years. And during that time, it's kind of what allowed America to build up so much wealth, when, I mean, I've heard people working for slave wages, but I don't think anything's going to be cheaper than people who are actually working for no money at all, zero, no income, wealth, nothing. And that's really what allowed the American economy to become so strong and powerful so quickly is off of the wealth and the exploitation of slave labor. And this didn't go, this concept of giving financial resources to Black people in order to help them to be competitive in the American economy is not a new concept. As a matter of fact, after the Civil War and slaves were freed, they were supposed to have received 30 acres and a mule to help them begin their, begin self-sufficiency. And they could use this land for farming, setting up other businesses. They could sell the land to use the money for investing. They could, whatever. There were many different options. They could pool their resources together with other Black people for some sort of collective wealth, but that never happened. They were never given those resources because after a Republican president won in the American, after a Democratic president actually had won an election at the time, they wanted to do this thing called Reconstruction where supposedly they were going to rebuild the South to make it a more equitable terms for Black people. And it just never really happened. And, that's what started the Jim Crow South and probably leads directly to the wealth disparity that we have today. So I personally, when I read this book, I was hoping to get Mr. Coates's whole philosophy and ideas and, and his drive for reparations. But really, the book had nothing to do with that. Zero. It's kind of more of a, I don't know how to say it. It's a bit of a combination of a poetic treatise on being Black in America. It is a part autobiography with Ta-Nehisi's growing up from the streets in Baltimore to attending Howard to dropping out of college to becoming a freelance journalist and living basically in poverty for many years to actually having a bit of success, traveling to Paris and talking to his son with this kind of stream of consciousness, I want to say, about what it means to be Black and what America has been like for other people, what he can expect and things that he should worry about. And it even becomes a bit of a cautionary tale for white people in a lot of ways. I think one of the most profound things that Ta-Nehisi talked about was how white people have this, I forget what the term he used, but it was pretty interesting. Like almost a fanatical drive to remove any sort of criticism or any sort of accountability in the past. And I actually had a discussion. I have some friends who come over and we talk sometimes about issues. And I was saying that, I get very fearful of the word racism very much. I almost don't even know what the point of the word is because from my own experience, I've never seen or met a white person who considered himself to be a racist, a misogynist, a bully. Most people just don't think of themselves in bad terms like that. And not only that, but when you actually do go so far as to call somebody a racist, that normally shuts down all communication right then and there, okay? The person just becomes hyper-defensive. They, you go back and forth trying to get into the specifics of what makes somebody a racist, what doesn't, or what's even the point. I mean, if the point is to try to bring somebody over to your side of thinking, then trying to be critical of the person is just, I don't find it to be effective. And I think that we experience this directly with the election of Donald Trump because so many people are along the lines of thinking like, oh, well, if you're a Trump supporter, then you're a racist. Well, let's not forget about half the voting public voted for Donald Trump. Okay, a little bit less than that, like 45% or something. To call all of those people racists is just basically to I mean, I'm not saying whether they are, whether they're not. I mean, it seems silly to me that many people would be racially, I guess, prejudiced. I can't think of a better word for it. But how in the world are you going to find any kind of common ground with these people if your main mode of communication is to put them on the defensive end? So that's one of the things that actually Ta-Nehisi did. He did talk about that, and that's been one of the difficult things about having dialogue with white people is just because of their fanatical nature to defend themselves. So I don't really know how to go about doing that. And even in his book, towards the end, he even says that he's not really sure exactly how the situation is going to fix itself. He was saying that every empire eventually will cannibalize itself. I think that's almost exactly what he said. And maybe the American Empire is no different. I mean, we've been a country now for, what is it? I guess about 240 years or something. And we're kind of getting to that point in time where there is, one of my friends talked about this. He said there tends to be a natural progression with empires in that you have a first generation where everybody has incredible ambition. Then, you know, you have another generation where the ambition is still there, maybe not quite as fanatical. And then with each subsequent generation, they slip a little bit further and further into decadence until finally the empire crumbles and then, you know, a new empire will begin. And I don't know if that's going to happen, mostly because we live in such a globalized society these days that it's difficult to say what the future is going to be. Maybe in the future, there'll just be one nation. And therefore, you can't have separate, you know, empires. I'm not really sure. I'm not sure how this is all going to play out. I mean, it certainly won't happen in my lifetime, but I would love to have a crystal ball to be able to see what the world will look like in 200 years. I don't know. I think it's going to be fascinating. So one of the things I think I will take away from the book is Ta-Nehisi's metaphor of the body. And he talks about the body as a metaphor in that it's the most sacred gift that anybody has. With your body comes choices. You can become or do, or at least attempt to become or do, whatever it is that you want. It gives you the ability to lease out your labor. It gives you the ability to expound on intellectual thoughts. It gives you the ability to be competitive against other people's bodies. And so there's just this theme constantly running through the book about the importance of the body. And the reason he does this, I'm going to assume, is because he says that throughout Black people's history in America, their bodies have been basically a tool for exploitation. I mean, first, in the most savage way possible, of course, would be slavery. But they said even after that, he talks a lot about the situation with police brutality with Black men. And he was just saying that when you do that, when you assault, when you harm, when you murder people, he says what you're doing is you're taking away their most prized gift. You're taking away their body. And he says you don't even necessarily have to like harm people all the time for that. All you have to do is instill the psychological fear that somebody could be attempting to come harm your body, which kind of links to one of the more interesting moments of his book, I thought, is he talks about how, you know, this is probably going to be in the future. He's probably made a little bit of money now writing as a journalist. His wife, I forget what she did for a living, but apparently she's, you know, pretty successful in her career. And so he was just saying that he had taken his young son, who I guess was about 5 or 6 at the time, I don't remember. They went to go watch a movie in Manhattan. And in Manhattan, I mean, we're talking about one of the liberal bastions of America. And he said it was a crowded movie, so a lot of different people were coming down the escalator. They were kind of squished up together. And a white woman behind his son had, like, I guess, bumped into his young son, and the boy fell. And then the woman, instead of being apologetic or anything, she actually kind of got aggressive and was saying, you know, don't stand there. You got to move. You're blocking people. And Ta-Nehisi, he said he immediately sort of reverted back to his, I don't know what the word is, street mentality, I suppose. And he became very verbally aggressive. And he was saying that there were some other people in the crowd who immediately came to the woman's defense. And the whole situation just got really ugly and heated. And he was saying that, you know, he was really disappointed because nobody had come to his son's defense. It was just a situation of they saw this black guy who was being verbally aggressive towards this white woman, and they felt a need to be this knight in shining armor. He calls them, he said, a race of Luke Skywalkers, people who want to come to the defense of people who are like them. He said that afterwards he felt really silly, and he felt even more than that, humiliated and stupid, because he was saying that making those kind of mistakes could very easily lead to the authorities coming to take away his body. And, you know, I think the statistics are pretty clear. Police officers, when they harm other people, very rarely, almost never, do they suffer any consequences for it. And I know that's going to take this in a completely separate direction that I don't want to go into, but I do want to say that I don't know. I understand that there are psychological fears that black men have to deal with that other people do not. And I think sometimes the fears are overblown. Okay. I know that, for example, I think on average somewhere between 100 to 130 black men are killed every year by police officers. But I mean, there's thousands and thousands of just regular urban street murders that happen among black people every year. And I do think that the psychological fear of police officers, because of the headlines that they tend to get in the media, can create a psychological prison in some ways, of where you might feel as if, you know, you could be harmed and destroyed at any point in time. And I understand that that's not really something white people have to deal with, the psychological fear. And then I started thinking about this, and I came to the conclusion that whether a fear is rational or not, it doesn't make it any less of a fear, especially when the fear is grounded on empirical facts. So I don't know. This is a tough issue. I certainly don't have the answers. I don't know what is the right way. I don't know what is the right path. Actually, I take that back. I am of the, if you want to know my own personal belief system, I actually am of the belief system that unless we have some sort of system of reparations for black people, I just don't see how they can ever get on any kind of equal footing in America. I remember one of the more poignant things I heard when I was in grad school and I was taking a racial diversity class was one of the professors said, the racial disparity gaps are so extreme at this point in time that even if not a single racist act was committed from here on in, it still wouldn't be enough to help black people get to a position of equality. Now, the counter argument to this, of course, is, you know, we have affirmative action. We have special funding for black people. Businesses all over the country are constantly looking for black people, especially black men. They'll hire them if they have any kind of education and carry themselves well, then these sort of businesses are dying to hire black people just because they're terrified of being sued for racial discrimination. They need to up their numbers. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. I'm not sure. These are complicated issues. I certainly think that if we're unwilling to talk about them, then nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to improve. I don't know if it's possible to have a balanced conversation about this. I don't know. It's a complicated issue. But getting back to the book, it was an interesting read. It's part poetry, part stream of consciousness, part rallying call. I think that as the situation goes forward, things are are going to have to change for the better or for the worse. They certainly can't stay the same. And I don't know how this will all play out, but I'm glad that Ta-Nehisi, in a very short book, I think the book's only like 150-ish pages, really created a jumping point of conversation in an easily to access book for all genders and ethnicities to enjoy. And maybe this can be a starting point for conversation. So if you're interested in this subject and maybe seeing the world through somebody else's point of view that is unlike your own, or maybe is like your own if you have experienced something similar, then I do recommend Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Well, that's all for now. I actually do know which book I'm going to be reviewing next week. I'm going to be reviewing Peggy Orenstein's Girls and Sex. So thank you again for making it all the way to the end of the episode, and stay tuned for the next episode, and thanks again for listening. And until then, happy reading.